Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by ToughManTri.com, RunCatalina.com. Run Catalina, the Catalina Eco Marathon coming up on Saturday, November 19th by everyone.org, EveryWon. The half marathon and 5K is on December 11th here in San Diego. OSKA Wellness, OSKA Wellness, the cool new product for pain relief. Our Challenge Athlete Foundation, we've raised over $75 million to give challenge athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, let's see, two ITU World Championships, Olympic silver medal in the first ever Olympic triathlon back in 2000, Ironman Championship 2006, Try Australia Hall of Fame, ITU Hall of Fame, Sport Australia Hall of Fame. McKaylee Jones, the woman who has done it all, joins us. How are you doing, MJ?
Hi, Bob. How are you? I'm doing great.
I am wonderful. So take me back a little bit. I know you were doing triathlon from middle school and just forever. When did you...
Middle school? Come on.
Earlier?
No, I was later. I was like basically my first year of college.
The first year of college.
Yeah.
So, and what got you into it?
My high school run coach, John White, he suggested I do this race called the Champion of Sydney, and it was like a 1 kilometer swim and a 10 kilometer run. And then from there, I started doing some sprint triathlons, and yeah, it just kept... competing, and that's how I basically paid my way through college. And yeah, when you look back, you go, wow, it's like thanks to him saying, maybe you should do this swim run event, that I can say that I've done all these wonderful things in the sport.
Well, and at that time, so growing up, you and your sister were both into horses, right? You were doing horse shows and things like that.
Oh yeah, it's like definitely used to getting up at like early hours, getting the horses ready and competing most weekends and getting up before school and riding horses after school. So it definitely helped build a great work ethic.
When did you realize that, this isn't just a hobby, this triathlon thing? This could be a way, because you were planning to be a teacher, and next thing you know, you're a professional triathlete.
Yeah, I still do have a degree in teaching, although I've never taught. So I definitely finished my degree, and then I came over to the U.S. In 1991 to race, and wasn't exactly the perfect start. I got injured the first couple of weeks here, and then first couple of races, I just missed out on prize money. And actually, thanks to this guy named Bob Babbitt, I actually got my first sponsor.
Exactly. So, that was really fun. I remember calling Greg Work from Danskin, and he's saying, hey, this girl looks Danskin. And next thing you know, you were winning every race on the Danskin circuit. And we're talking those in the 90s, triathlon was a non-drafting sport. And there was a point there where triathlon got into the Olympics. But to get into the Olympics, it became a draft legal sport. How hard was that transition for you from, because you were a great cyclist, all of a sudden you had to change your game?
Yeah, definitely, I have to say, I was a purist. I like to swim, bike, and run. And I definitely, had worked hard to swim well, bike well, and run well. And, the transition wasn't as tough as some other people, because I had worked really hard on my swimming, biking, and running. So the transition was actually not too bad. It took me a couple of years, though, to do the drafting races, because I definitely was totally against it. And, once I knew it was going to be on the Olympic program, I definitely wanted to be part of that, to have triathlon the first ever time in the Olympics in my home country of Australia. It's like I definitely wanted to be a part of that.
So were there some world championships that you didn't go to because they were draft legal?
Yes. I didn't go to the world championships in 94, 95, and 96.
Wow, and that's after you had won a couple.
Yeah, I won in 92 and 93. I medaled in 1991. And then when I came back in 1997, that was the year that I got run down by a French triathlete and in the transition, and ended up with stitches in both feet, but I still ended up with a bronze medal.
Well, I remember that because your foot got caught in her spokes, right?
Yeah,
it basically
it's
just
bladed,
ripped.
The good old bladed spokes aren't too good if you land in them.
Man, and you've, in terms of your ITU Worlds, and not including ones you didn't go to, you had 2 gold, 2 silver, 4 bronze. So obviously you were on the podium all the time. I mean, you look back at those ITU Worlds and go, darn, I probably should have gone.
No, not really. I mean, I can't ever second guess what I did.
Yeah.
I mean, I just.
You're making a statement.
And, you know, I wanted to support my sponsors in the U.S. They had supported me over the years. So it wasn't like I was really missing out because, you know, I had so many opportunities to race in the States. But part of that was the Dancing Series where I had the opportunity to do these sprint races with other professional athletes. And it hasn't been till recently in the ITU that they've actually brought the sprint distance in to international competition. So definitely for me, when I was doing my training program way, way back, it's like part of that was doing sprint races. And a lot of triathletes don't do that. And now you have the opportunity to actually do these ITU races that are sprint distance. And I think that's a great way to develop, for one, younger athletes, because you don't need as much endurance, but it definitely develops good leg speed and, you know, quick transitions. You know, these races are so competitive, it's like you have to fine-tune all your skills.
I have a feeling that, because like Hamburg this year was a sprint, and they've sprinkled in a number of sprints for those WTS races. My gut is that by 2020 or 2024, we'll see the Olympic distance be the sprint distance, because it certainly is better for television having something that's 45 or 50 minutes rather than an hour 40.
Well, I'd like to see both of them in there.
Yeah, that would be nice.
But yeah, I mean, even though, you know, you definitely see, you know, the top athletes doing well, but you also see some athletes that definitely can specialize in that sprint distance but don't necessarily cross over to that two-hour race, that hour 50, two-hour race. And, I mean, that just tells you that, you know, it is an endurance sport, and, you know, running a 5K to a 10K is very different. Swimming 750 to 1500 meters is very different. So I just think it's a good way to develop athletes and definitely give, you know, some of these younger athletes or athletes that aren't quite suited to the Olympic distance a chance to do well at some of those shorter races.
I think people at this stage sort of take the fact that we're in the Olympics for granted, because we're, you know, going into our fifth Olympics, but you were there for the very first Olympic triathlon in 2000 in Sydney.
First day, first medal event.
Exactly. And really, NBC was using the triathlon as a travelogue to basically show the world the city of Sydney with the Opera House and the bridge and everything else. So they were all in on triathlon, and obviously triathlon is a big sport in Australia. How magical was that day in terms of the crowds, and just because I think that day was pivotal in terms of the future of the sport?
I mean, for one, you couldn't have a better backdrop. I mean, it was absolutely spectacular, and you know, it came down to a sprint, which is good for TV.
Yep.
There's no doubt about it. And the crowd support, I mean, Australia loves triathlon, and you could definitely tell, because, I mean, it was so loud, so emotional, just, like, very patriotic. I mean, definitely racing in your home country at the Olympics just is very, very special. But, you know, they did a fantastic job with the course, because it wasn't, like, flat. It was technical. Mm-hmm. It had lots of good things throughout. So definitely, you know, you had to be a well-rounded athlete. So I think that really was showcased. And, I just think it was just the scene, the backdrop was just spectacular. I mean, you'll never get a venue. There's no way you can get a venue that's better than that.
When you're being introduced and you're walking down to, you know, get on the dock.
And I start crying because I look up in the stands and my twin sister Gabby's crying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, you were sort of there as triathlon came of age, as it became an Olympic sport, and now here you are in your home country with, you know, tons of fans and family there, and you're about to start the first official Olympic triathlon. I'm imagining the goosebumps were pretty crazy.
Oh, yeah, but I think one thing that I did, like, probably very different to everyone else, you know, I just kept everything the same as I would leading into a normal race. And, you know, I was definitely used to dealing with the media right up into the race. I mean, I definitely knew what my warm-up routine was going to be, and that's super, super important. I sort of had raced on the course the two times, so I definitely knew the course suited me, so that always gave me a lot of confidence. You know, definitely there was a lot of pressure. Don't get me wrong. It's like, you know, people expected Australia to totally dominate, because you got to remember, we finished first, second, third, and fourth, and fifth at the World Championships the year before. So just making the Australian team was going to be tough. And if you didn't make it, you know, that was the number one goal. It's like, because then there wasn't another goal if you didn't make it. And, you know, Olympic pressure and Olympic trials and Olympic selection is very unique, and you never know, you know, you never know what's going to happen. You never know what the selection committee is going to do. And, you know, it all comes down into, you know, how your country decides what that selection process is going to be.
So you end up, and I had watched you in a lot of sprint finishes over time, and I'd never seen you not win one. In this particular one, Bridget McMahon from Switzerland wins, and she gets the gold and you get the silver. But what I loved about your attitude that whole time afterwards was, I didn't lose the gold, I won the silver. And you did, right? You won the silver.
And you know, triathlon's so dynamic, anything can happen. And, you know, the Olympic experience, you get these athletes that come up on any given day and they have, like, an unbelievable performance, and then sometimes you never see them again.
Right.
Or, you know, things just don't, you know, it's just not meant to be. And, you know, triathlon's tough enough because you've got to swim, bike, and run, and you throw that in, and then you throw the fact that, you know, high-pressure situation of the Olympics. It's like, you know, I knew I did everything I could on the day. I can't change. I mean, definitely, you know, you go back and you go, you know, I should have done this, I should have done that. But the reality is, it's like, I still think I had a great race. I still think I did everything I could on the day. And, you know, like everyone, yeah, I wish I won the gold in some way, but that wasn't my destiny.
What I love about it, too, is, you know, a number of years later, Bridget McMahon gets popped for, I think it was EPO. And obviously the first thought is, well, you know, she probably was using 4 years earlier at the Olympics.
At the biggest race in the world?
Yeah. You think if she's using it at a lesser race 4 years later, you would assume. But you've never been one of those people, because you hear, hey, I would have gotten the medal if this person hadn't been using or whatever. But you don't seem to be bogged down in that minutia.
No, I look at it, and, you know, other people look at it differently because they've told me that. But I look at it as, you know what, I can live with every decision that I've made.
Yes.
And I can't control what other people do. I can only control. So I think I've always sort of had the attitude, well, I can live with everything that I did, can the other person.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, it's like, you know, I'm still, a silver medal is still a pretty cool trophy, let me tell you. So,
does it surprise you to this day? Yeah, I mean, you can, someone can be the richest guy or gal in the world, and when they see an Olympic medal, it's like they're 5 years old, right?
It stops them in their tracks. Even when I pull it out, I'm like, this is pretty cool. I have one of these, you know?
Yeah.
It's definitely, you know, it is prestigious, and it does have that cool value, and people get affected by it, and I love sharing my medal with other people. And, you know, I look back and I go, I never thought I'd get an Olympic medal, and, you know, I have one, and, you know, it is something very special, and I feel, I mean, it's awesome that I have one. There's no doubt about it, and that's, you know, every time I look at it and I get it out and I share it with somebody or I share it with a group, I'm like, holy cow, I did this.
This is mine, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I'm early 90s, you come over to, I think it was early or mid-90s, come over to Kona. Basically vacation, watch the Ironman. And I remember standing at the finish there, and we're watching Mark Allen, who's won the race, on a stretcher.
He didn't look so good.
No, his feet are bleeding. His body's quivering. And you sort of looked at me like, never. I will never do this race. Because this is a guy who won. And he looked like he was, you know, on his way to the hospital.
See, See, I think of myself as a speed demon. I'm
right.
no diesel engine.
Right.
And that's one thing I think Paula was really good at turning me back into. It's like, okay, Mikula, you have all this speed. Let's make you a fast diesel engine.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, the reason why I did Ironman and even thought about it is because I didn't make the 2004 Olympics, which was absolutely devastating because, you know, I'd won on the Athens of course.
Yes, the year before. You'd won on the course. You won on the test race.
I knew it was going to suit me.
Yes.
But unfortunately, it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah.
So I got to do Ironman instead. And Paula was just really smart in realizing, you know, I had a small opportunity. I mean, I was going to be 36.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So I only had like a small opportunity, you know, 35, 36 to get it right. And you know, I'd been in triathlon for a long time before that point. So it wasn't like I was like only in the sport for a couple of years and then decided to do Ironman. I was in the sport for a long, long time before I started like thinking about Ironman. And Ironman wasn't something that I ever thought I could do.
Right.
So that was definitely one of the reasons why I didn't want to do it. It's like, to me, I'd rather go run a 5K. Where my friends who, like, are Ironman athletes, they'd rather go and run a marathon.
Always. Yeah, I know. No, me and you are the same, man. I'd rather do something that takes an hour. That's always more fun. So when you don't make the team in 2004, and then you start, you know, Paul Newby Frazier is like, hey, well, how about thinking about this Ironman thing? You come over in 05 and leading it till about mile 18. And I know you hadn't done much running leading in because you were dealing with injuries.
Oh, yeah. I, like, crashed my bike at the escape from Alcatraz, and I couldn't run. You know, I fractured my hips. So I couldn't do any running. So here I am going into my first ever Kona.
Yes.
And it'll be my second ever Ironman, and I just don't have the run miles in my legs. It's like, you know, it was just one of those things. But, you know, I knew I was swimming well. I knew I was biking well. And, you know, and then I'm leading the race.
Yeah, until mile 18. I mean, not just leading the race.
And let me tell you, it's not like I was thinking, okay, here comes such and such, and I'm just going to try to stay with her.
Right.
Of course I thought that. I was like, holy cow, I'm going to try. And my legs were like, no. Mind was willing, the body was not.
But you come back the following year, and you've always been a quick study. So you win in 2006. You had taken home a silver medal on the world's biggest stage, which is the Olympics. Were you surprised that the response on – there's something special about winning the Ironman. And it seems to touch a lot of people, sometimes more than the Olympics.
Well, you know, it's like a track runner coming over and doing the marathon.
Yeah.
You know, not many people can do that. So definitely, for me, it was like, holy cow, I can't believe I went from a 2-hour race to a 9-hour race because, you know, it's totally different athletes. You know, now we've had, you know, some success, but, you know, you look at it, there's not really many athletes that have been able to do it when you look at the history of the sport. I mean, definitely certain people have dominated the sport, and definitely, you know, you see, it's like, you know, you get someone who may be a great athlete. And, you know, Jan Frodeno is an awesome athlete. And, you know, he's now been able to do the double, the Olympics. You know, one better than me, got the gold medal, and now the Ironman. So when you look at how many people have done it, it's not a lot.
No.
There's only two of us that have medals and have Ironman World Championship titles. So it's not easy to do.
No, that's what always impresses me when you look at it, like a Rod Dixon back in the day when he wins or takes the bronze at 1500 meters and 11 years later wins New York City Marathon. That's the type of stuff that always gets me when someone can change their game. That's amazing to me that someone can go from that short to something that long. What was the toughest part of that adaptation for you? Just being patient?
Sitting on a bicycle seat for that long?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And eating.
But, yeah, definitely being patient. Nutrition was huge. I mean, I struggled with nutrition. It's like, you know, when you're used to taking very little. And, you know, nutrition back, you know, 10 years ago was very different how it is today.
Right.
I mean, there weren't a huge amount of choices. And there's still not a lot of knowledge because, you know, people have a lot of nutrition issues to this day.
No question.
It's like, you know, there's so many things that, you know, made it more difficult. And, you know, some people have no issues and some people do. I mean, that's what makes our sport so exciting and dynamic.
So here you are, a pro for a lot of years. You go to Ironman Florida, and I think you like doubled your nutrition, or you know, something. Something I'm sure Paula was you did what?
I screwed up. I pretty much screwed up. I was like thinking that I needed to pack a lot of calories, where I needed to really like think. And you know, your body changes too, because once you start, you know, getting into that Ironman training, you know, your body gets smart at using the calories. And I just didn't take a lot of that into consideration. And like, you know, when I first started doing my long mileage, I definitely needed a lot more calories. And then as, you know, your body gets used to using the calories you have and processing the calories that you're putting into your body, you definitely have to readjust. And I totally screwed up and I puked. As soon as I got grabbed this big bloated stomach, as soon as I crossed the finish line, I puked everywhere. I'm like, okay, I'm good now. I feel good.
So looking back at what has been an amazing career, what do you consider your best race ever?
You know, that it's such a tough question because I think I've had some like unbelievable races that maybe weren't even like, you know, when I won the 70.3 distance in Davis, California, and I beat everyone, the guys, you know, that was pretty cool to like actually like win a 70.3 overall. And you know, I always tried to do it in a sprint race, and I think I only, I don't know, I can't even recall, maybe once I won overall.
Nice.
So, you know, definitely that. And then one time in Australia in the F1 races, which were like made for TV, super short, I lapped the entire field on the bike.
The men too?
No, because the men race separate.
Oh, that's right.
But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Just but to like be able to lap someone in like such a short time, I mean, that was pretty cool. Besides, you know, the Olympics and Ironman, because, you know, that's a huge deal and an awesome memory. It's, you know, some of these smaller races, it's like, you know, and I like to do the race within the race where, as you know, Bob, we always have a little bet.
Exactly.
Did I beat you on the weekend or did you beat me?
I think I went 138, so I don't know what you
I went 125.
Oh, so you beat me by 13 minutes. Jeez. But, of course, our age difference is about, I think I'm like 20 over you. Now, you're 46 now. How have you had to change your game to still be successful at the age of 46?
Oh, my goodness. It's so different.
Yeah, it is, right? You got to do all the flexibility, all the strength, all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I mean, I struggle like everyone else with injuries and making sure, I mean, sometimes my attention to detail is not quite as good as it should be. And, I mean, that's one thing that you do have to spend some time. And I'm like everyone else. I get a little lazy about it, and then all of a sudden I'll be like, oh, I should have been doing this, and this. So, I mean, it's not like I don't try to go as hard as I can. I'm just not as fast as I used to be. It feels like I'm going as hard as I used to, but I'm just not quite as fast. So definitely for me, it's like, yeah, I still want to do triathlon and there's still things that I'm trying to achieve. But I also, you know, I have a couple of horses that I like to ride and I love coaching all my athletes. So, you know, I just try to make the most of out of my time. But, you know, I have to be careful that, you know, because my perspective sometimes is a little different to other people's perspective. Because, you know, if I want to do an Ironman again, I'm like, oh, I have it in the head what I did as a pro of how I would train. But that's not the reality of how my body would take it, you know, taking into account my age, that, you know, time constraints. So, you know, it's definitely a different focus. But, you know, I'm still passionate about it. And I think that's what has kept me in the sport, because, you know, you can't be in this sport unless you love it and are passionate about it.
No question. So when you, as a coach, you mentioned the other day that the one thing you've noticed with athletes you coach is that the difference between an age group and a pro is the age groupers sort of have, hey, you're going to go easy, you're going to go hard, and they don't quite know the difference. Where if you're an elite athlete, you totally know the difference between easy and hard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know that what it's like to go easy. And, you know, some people think they just have to keep going hard and hard and hard, but that's not necessarily the case. But you have to understand that there's days when you have to go easy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to have the confidence to be able to do that. And that's where I think some of the age groupers don't have the confidence to be able to, you know, go, okay, I'm going to go easy. And, I mean, one thing I was really good at it when I was tired, I'm like, okay, I'm tired. I need to chill out a little bit. So it's important to like teach your athletes that, you know, when we say go easy, go easy. When you need to put the effort in, put the effort in, because you don't want to be a champion trainer. You want to be a champion racer.
Love that. So let's talk a little Katie Kelly. And here's a sight-impaired athlete from Australia. And here's Makili Jones, multiple-time ITU champion, Olympic silver medalist in the first-ever Olympic triathlon. Triathlon now is in the Paralympics for the first time in 2016 in Rio. And you are teammates with Katie Kelly. Now, it's one thing doing triathlon. You're doing it on your own. There's a lot of pressure when you're a quote-unquote a teammate, and especially when you're guiding somebody who is counting on you, not just to be her eyes, but with the Usher syndrome, I think she's almost deaf as well, correct?
Yeah, it's a hearing and sight impairment disease, and eventually she'll lose both her sight completely and her hearing completely. So,
wow.
You know, just some of these para athletes have amazing, amazing stories, and, you know, the things that they deal with, it's like, it's so inspiring. But let me tell you, yes, it is nerve-wracking. I mean, Katie always tells me, are you kidding? I have to live up to your expectation of who you are. And I go, no. I have, like, nightmares about she's waiting for me to put my helmet on.
Right. Yeah.
Or waiting for me to put my shoes on. Or, you know, it's like you have to know the course very well. I mean, they're making sure that, you know, you're swimming straight, making sure, you know, you're handling the bike so that you don't crash. I mean, and even on the run, it's like, you know, you've got to run their race. They can't run your race.
Well, I remember years ago I paced my friend Tom Sullivan in a number of races, and I was never as emotionally drained as just doing a 10K with him and worrying about every crack in the road, right? Every curb,
exactly.
Every crack, every overhanging branch. Your nerves are just, you're basically, your senses are on overload because you've got a 41-year-old deaf and blind, or, you know, sight impaired athlete on the back of the bike that you're responsible for.
Exactly. And, you know, it's like, I mean, I feel bad. If we hit a bump, I know the bump's coming. It's like, she doesn't know. It's like, I know how soft I can put my butt on the saddle.
Right.
She doesn't know. It's like, you know, and I'm always like, sorry.
But then you guys go and you teamed up last year in Yokohama. I think it was like May of last year you guys win.
Yes.
And then you guys go to the World Championships in Chicago and win the gold. And not just win the gold. And these are sprint distance races. So you got a 5K off the bike. How far back were you guys off the bike?
We actually led off the bike.
You led off the bike in Chicago?
Yeah.
Which race was it where you guys came from behind?
That was Italy.
Italy. And you basically said to Katie something like, we're going to have to hurt here.
Yeah, I'm like, if you don't go now, you got no chance.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's, I mean, you know, just giving her the confidence and knowing when you have to push in a race.
Yes.
I think that's probably where my expertise really helps her, because I definitely am good at knowing, okay, this is where it counts. This is what you have to do. I mean, and each race scenario is different. You know, sometimes it's like, you know, in Chicago, she came in with no running at all because she was carrying a little injury. So I'm like, look, just do your best you can, and I will get you to the finish line just in the best way that I can get you there. And that's, you know, just making sure, you know, she doesn't go out too hard. She keeps a steady pace. But, you know, I've also got to keep an eye on the competition as well.
Yeah. So what's cool about the Paralympics, and here you, like I said, you've got a Olympic silver, you've got an Ironman gold. Now you're going to the Paralympics. You get the same medal as the athlete, correct?
Apparently.
You don't think that far ahead yet, huh? Now, what do you know? Did you race on that course last year?
No, unfortunately. I mean, this is the hard part when you get athletes that are coming into the sport who haven't been doing, and, you know, just, you can't get into the races for one because,
right,
you know, they're very competitive. And unfortunately, you know, it wasn't until March where Katie actually and the federation, you know, got together and started thinking about that, you know, she could be a para triathlete. And so just getting into the races was really, really tough. So we haven't been on the course. I think it will suit us.
It's a challenging course, right? The bike course is challenging.
Yeah, and I like that. I mean, I definitely, I mean, it's hard on the Tanzim when you're on the technical courses, but I think
it's hard for everybody.
And hopefully it will suit us. I mean, we haven't done any racing on it. I haven't physically seen it. I've heard a lot about it.
So when will you go down? Will you guys get some chance? Will you get a chance to pre-ride that course?
Yeah, normally like the day before you get to ride it.
Okay.
But, you know, it's like, I mean, for us, I mean, we're very unique. I mean, power to Coach Corey, the Australian paratriathlon coach, for partnering us together. And, you know, thinking that I live in the U.S. and she lives in Australia and we can make this work.
Right.
I mean, oh, my goodness, you know, how they thought that was going to work. But, you know, we just get together before the races. I mean, sometimes it's been a day. Sometimes it's been a couple of days. Sometimes it's been a couple of weeks. So definitely leading into Rio, we'll have about 3 weeks together. So,
perfect.
You know, for me, it's just making sure it's not like we're going to try to swim, bike, and run together a lot. It's just making sure we have good communication, we're in sync.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the most important thing.
Well, and the little things, which you're so good at, right? That's the little things you bring to the table. The other thing is you've been connected with us at Challenge Athlete Foundation since we started the foundation in 93. So you've had a lot of experience with, you know, meeting and knowing a little and a lot about challenged athletes. Has that helped?
Exactly. Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, you know, I've basically, you know, grown up just like with the Challenge Athletes Foundation. I mean, it's been a big part of the triathlon community here in San Diego. So I've been exposed to that, and I know a number of the athletes. So, you know, I understand, and, you know, I was coaching a couple of the athletes leading into the paratriathlon as well. So definitely, you know, for me, it's awesome to coach these athletes because, you know, it pushes you as a coach to think differently to an able-bodied athlete because there's a whole different set of circumstances that you've got to take into consideration. And so for me, I mean, I love it. I love the challenge of figuring it out and pushing the athletes, you know, beyond what they think their expectation is.
Well, one of the things I thought was really cool is you've been working with Sarah Reinertsen, the single above knee amputee, the first woman to finish, first single above knee amputee to finish Ironman and was on Amazing Race. And the transformation in her racing this last year has been pretty amazing. What did you see in Sarah before you started coaching her, and what have you done to get her going as well as she's been going?
Well, I've known Sarah for a long time. I mean, I've seen so much of what she's done over her career, and, you know, I know she's a little tough cookie, and I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I admire that because, you know, you can work any athlete that, you know, is super tough. You can definitely finesse that, and when she came to me late last year, I was like, okay, this is what we need to do. And it was hard, though, because you don't want to disrupt the athlete's program too much because they've got Olympic selection they've got to think about.
Sure.
So, you know, a lot of the times when you coach an athlete, they've got to take some steps backwards in order to progress forward. So we just, like, you know, I'm like, okay, this is your weaknesses. This is what you need to work on. This is what you're good at. Let's take advantage of that. And, I mean, that's how I wrote the program. Just let's work a little bit more on your weaknesses, but let's make sure that your strength is at its maximum capacity of what you're capable of as well.
How impressed have you been with Katie Kelly? I mean, this is a woman who, again, 41 years old and just so strong and so committed.
The fact that she'll tell you the story how I made her puke at a race.
Yes, that was my favorite. She did that in Chicago.
I made her push so hard.
Yeah. Was that Italy? Was that where you made her puke? Okay.
Yeah. She's like, Michaela, you're the only one that I would give that much to. And, I mean, for me, that's motivating. It's like, you know, she has faith in me. She trusts me. And you know, for somebody to be willing to give, like, beyond, you know, what they're even capable of, I mean, that shows a lot of character. I mean, you know, she's an awesome athlete, but she's an awesome person, and she definitely is taking full advantage of the opportunity that she's been given because, I mean, that's one thing, you know, when you are going to be losing your sight and you are going to be losing your hearing, it's like you know, your independence gets taken away.
Right.
And, you know, she's very independent. So, you know, I was very respectful and, you know, she appreciated that because that was the first thing I was like, well, I want to make sure that, you know, I'm fair to what she's trying to achieve, but also respectful in how I do it. So, you know, even how you touch that person or guide that person, you know, that can be respectful or disrespectful.
Exactly.
Because, you know, they're very independent and mm-hmm. it's like, you know, you've got to be very respectful of that. So lots of little unique things that you learn along the way.
How hard has it been, like, doing this thing with a tether, right? Right. Because you're like a freaking thoroughbred. You just want to go. And I'm sure
well,
like,
you know, you've got to also look at, you know, how we are, like, together because, you know, I'm tall and
yes.
she's, like, a lot smaller. So, you know, we definitely... This, and that was one of the reasons why they weren't going to ask me to do it, is just getting a fit on the tandem.
Right.
You know, because I'm so tall and, you know, she's so small. I mean, just getting a good fit was a struggle. And then, you know, swimming, it's like we can't, there's no way we can swim shoulder to shoulder because of the way the tether is.
Right.
It's impossible. It's like, you know, I have this big long stroke and she'll never have that. And then, you know, even running, it's like, you know, I have a fairly long stride. She has a shorter stride. So, you know, just our physical makeup makes us like we wouldn't think that we would be a good match.
So who do you have to watch out for down in Rio? I know you're a student of all of this.
Yeah.
It's pretty stacked, right? They've got a bunch of teams that are great.
Yes. The P5 women's category is really, really competitive. I mean, that category is sort of a split category because you have the B1 athletes that are basically blind and they have to race with blockout glasses.
Right.
And then you have the B2, B3, which is more on, you know, legally blind to, you know, almost blind. It's probably the best way to describe it. So, you know, the B1 athletes get like a 3-45 minute head start, which is a lot. And you have some talented athletes in that B1 category that you've got to make up in a sprint race that's just over an hour, three minutes and 45 seconds.
Wow.
So, you know, that's tough. And then you've got, you know, these other great athletes that are super competitive. I mean, the two British girls are super competitive. The Spanish girl is super competitive. A couple of the Americans, you know, it's crazy how competitive it is.
Well, which is great for the first ever Paralympics, right? It's going
to
be a battle. It'll be great television.
Yeah, I mean, definitely going into the race, it's like you have to get everything right. That's the first thing that you have to make sure that, you know, you have quick transitions and you're smooth on the bike and, you know, you can really go on the run because there's some girls that run under 20 minutes in that category.
Wow.
Now, and there's not many age group women who can run under 20 minutes for the 5K.
What is Katie running?
You know, she's under the 20-minute mark.
Wow.
So, yes. And, I mean, that's what's complicated as well, you know, trying to find guides that are fast enough because, you know, there's rules and regulations. You know, I couldn't have a pro card to be a guide.
Right.
You know, you can't have a pro card. I mean, and you have to find athletes that can swim, bike, and run as fast as some of these athletes.
I know that was always a problem for Aaron Scheides. I mean, he was a guy who was running; he was going 2 hours for Olympic distance races. And you're like, who can do that besides a pro?
No, exactly. So it definitely, I mean, and with the evolution of the sport, you know, that's going to get tougher and tougher.
It really is. Hey, Makili, enjoy Rio. We will definitely see you down there. I'll be down there for about a week. What do you know? What day you guys are racing?
Yes, we're racing September 11.
Oh, I think we're there. I love it.
Yay.
I love
Yay.
It. That'll be great. Makili Jones has been our guest. Oh, Makili, if people want to have you coach them, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
They can go directly to my website, giddyupmultisports.com.
Giddyupmultisports.com. Love that. Makili, as always, thanks so much for taking so much time.
All right, have a great evening, and I will see you in Rio.
All right. Again, we are brought to you by ToughManTry.com, RunCatalina.com. Catalina Eco Marathon coming up on Saturday, November 19th. Oscar Wellness, Everyone.org. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation. Check out any of our interviews on iTunes or on Babville.com. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.